at the start of the year here on Books and Arts, our producer Cassie McCullough told you and me that over the summer she'd been reading an advanced copy of a book called Scoundrel Days. Now, this is a memoir by the Brisbane writer Brently Fraser, based on extensive journals which he kept throughout his teens and his early 20s. It's his very gritty Gen X account of drug taking and alcohol abuse and violence and sexual escapades, all in the 1980s and 90s, mainly in far north Queensland. Now, Cassie told us that while much of the narrative rang true for her, she was not convinced by the sexual willingness of the young women in the story. The other detail I remember about this book that Cassie told us, and this is astonishing, the book is written without any use of the verb to be, which just sounds impossible to me. Well, the book's been released and it's had some very positive reviews, so it's a perfect time for Cassie to talk to Brently Fraser himself. Cassie.
Brently Fraser, welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is a memoir. What time are we talking about and where?
It begins with my earliest memories, sort of like a torch flashing around in a dark room of birth, and it ends in late 1998. Yeah, so the 70s, 80s, and most of the 90s.
Can you describe the narrative arc? What actually happens in that time frame?
Well, I was born into an obscure fundamentalist evangelical Christian cult. I became very aware early of the sort of hypocrisy of the way members of this cult were acting when they weren't being observed by the preachers, etc. And I sort of had a natural urge to get away from that sort of oppression. And at the time, I was very heavily influenced by Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, and I was very jealous that I never had the sort of adventures that happened to Tom. So I started to create my own adventures on purpose. For instance, I built a raft and ran away with a bunch of friends down a river for 3 days and had to get rescued and that sort of thing. I had this sort of natural inclination to write. It's just something that I've done. And at some point during my high school years, it occurred to me to start recording these adventures. And if I wasn't happy with them, to create an even more extreme adventure to write about. And then later on, of course, I discovered that other writers such as Hunter S. Thompson had done this exact sort of thing, immersing themselves in the story and becoming part of the story and instigating things that normally wouldn't happen on purpose, just to see what would happen for something to write about. So each time I kind of went back over my notes and tried to put this manuscript together, I realised that I hadn't lived enough, so I kept just pushing it further and further. So I moved to this small town when I was 5, spent my entire primary school years there. It was a small mining town with only a primary school, so my parents packed us up and moved us back to Townsville when I was 12 to start high school there. So I got involved with some housing estate thugs, a graffiti gang, got involved in shoplifting and all those sort of stupid things that kids did. I think the only difference for me was that I was writing these things down and no one else was. So that created a bit of suspicion also. There's this guy always writing down everything like I'm some sort of spy or a narc or something. So I started to kind of hide the writing and do it later on, just based on memories and things. Yeah, so I lugged this manuscript around until I felt I'd lived enough and I found a kind of redemptive point. Like I literally fell in love and stopped living that way, stopped pushing the boundaries so far, and I decided at that point that I'd try and get it down as a novel. But I realised I didn't have enough knowledge about novel writing. I had a lot of success with publishing poetry, but I really needed some serious education about writing a novel, so I enrolled in the Griffith Writing School, and they convinced me that it was essentially a memoir, which is really just a marketing term. Technically, Scoundrel Days is a non-fiction novel in the spirit of Capote, but that doesn't exist as a genre to tick in bookshops. So it's marketed as a memoir, but it's in no way stuffy like your average memoir, I hope.
It sure isn't, Brently. In fact, Rowan Wilson, writing in The Australian, called it a terrific book, but he also said, this is dirty realism at its dirtiest. And I think, you know, there's no kind of extreme of drug taking or alcohol abuse or gross out sexual acts that aren't covered. Is this what you kind of set out to do? Is it an anti-middle class, anti-bourgeois, anti-breakfast television kind of shock and awe attack that you've launched on us?
I never set out to shock or titillate any more than what is required to capture the attention of the readers in the ever-busy world. I used a technique called Recording Angel, which it doesn't allow you to make any judgments or to cast your own moral aspersions into the text. So I wrote about place and car accidents and sex in exactly the same voice, which is quite startling to some readers because they expect that sort of titillation. So it verges into pornography with no warning. But having said that, I've been noted as being a big fan and influenced by Henry Miller. And I'd like to point out, while that is true, I owe a lot to that kind of dirty realism and raw explicitness to Henry Miller. What I don't like about Henry Miller is his inherent misogyny and sexual violence and his overuse of gendered nouns. And I went really out of my way, because I'm naturally not like that anyway, went out of my way to make sure that never happened. So there's sort of like a push-pull between explicit but not a shocking judgmental explicitness, which I think disturbs some readers if they haven't ever embarked upon this kind of book before, because it's a specific kind of book. If you haven't read Miller or Arnais Nin or even some Helen Garner or William Burroughs, you're probably going to be a little shocked at first, I think.
Mm. Do you accept that some people will read this and see a level of misogyny?
Well, if you read closely, you'll note that I'm the passive partner in the vast majority of those sexual escapades. I wasn't doing anything that the other person didn't want to do or to happen. Yeah, so if you have another look, you'll see that the female is most often the instigator.
Well, in fact, that's part of my question, because I was around in the 80s and 90s as well, and I had a lot of friends who were in this milieu I feel that you're describing. And I don't know whether the girls were as up for it as they are in your book.
Well, you know, I prepared for this, Cassie. I heard you say that earlier on in the year. But I really think that teenagers, it's particularly in smaller country towns in the early 80s, were bored and very adventurous, and there were a lot of Catholic boarding schools where kids snuck out and went to parties and drank too much and were experimenting sexually. And this was before we started seeing the Reaper bowling people over in the AIDS bowling ball ads. But I don't know whether it was a blessing or a curse, but I was just the kind of guy that was non-threatening, up for an experience, not desiring to possess, and stuck around to last drinks quite a lot. So,
indeed. So are you trying to capture or preserve a moment in time, a kind of culture or a headspace? And do you think that's a culture that's gone now? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think that inner drive of human beings to be free and create will ever go away. Earlier I mentioned the influence of Rimbaud and the Ma Bohème, my bohemian life. When I was writing about these things, that was just part of the course. That was the way we lived. And we used to sit around, you know, in the days of cultural cringe, before Andrew McGann had written Praise and Nick Earls had written Zigzag Street and started to claim their local in the same way that the French writers would claim Voltaire Boulevard or the Beats would claim Times Square in New York. When I realised that that's the way we're living and I carried McGann's Praise around, it got me over that cultural cringe and made me feel more at home in Australia. I've always felt kind of disconnected in this stolen land. But so the decision to write my life story wasn't so much about the story, it was about how I wanted to tell it. And there's a distinct division there. Like, for the average casual need a book to go on the aeroplane or the bus reader, they're going to get a thrilling, fast-paced story that is sometimes explicit and shocking. But for the more astute readers, those who are more into the critical examination of a text, I've put a whole bunch of really new techniques which I borrowed back from the world of filmmaking, who borrowed a lot of their techniques in turn from Nabokov and his writing styles.
So a kind of cinematic approach.
Yeah, yeah. My narrator, I kind of, when I'm writing, I see the central figure who's in the words of Jean Genet, another big influence on me. He said the I in a story is only a slightly magnified character. It's not the central god figure. And also, like, I developed a bunch of techniques to get rid of the hidden observer that appears, the outside voice, like the Wonder Years voice, looking back on childhood, you know, and tainting all of those childhood sensibilities with an adult perspective.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that struck me, that this is, and I think you've alluded to it being potentially an unreliable memoir in some ways, but it's not a memoir that is seen from hindsight, with a benefit of hindsight. It's attempting to be in that headspace, and therefore there may not be the kind of reflections that we might want to see from a mature adult. We are seeing the headspace of a young man.
That's exactly right. I really tried to keep the wide-eyed, innocent outlook on the world as a boy and develop in the narrative arc I call it the entanglement complexity, the way that the narrator absorbs more concepts, how things take on a different context as the narrator matures. But as I said, with the average memoir, there's always the hidden observer looking into the story, whereas I've taken the observer and put him in to the story. There's no living outside of the text.
On Books and Arts, we're talking with Brently Fraser, who's written a book called Scoundrel Days, a memoir. Now, Brently, part of how you've achieved this effect is by the use of English prime, which is, a form of constrained writing. Describe that.
A little bit of background info on how come I used a literary constraint like that. When I pitched my memoir to do a PhD, a creative PhD, they told me, you know, you've got to be proving that you're contributing to knowledge, which is quite a thing to take on. So I said I wanted to write a memoir in first person present perfect, which hasn't been done. And they went, well, that's definitely, if you can pull it off, a contribution to knowledge.
I am walking down the street.
Yeah, yeah. So I tried to get this first person present perfect down, and that hidden observer kept creeping back in, tainting the sensibilities. So I had to try and find a way to get a more active, visceral text. And I remembered an obscure literary constraint that I discovered as a teenager at a book fair. I found a bunch of copies of Et Cetera, the Journal of General Semantics, from the 1950s and 60s.
As you do.
Yeah. I was attracted to these books because of their screen-printed covers originally, but then I started to read them and I discovered that a Polish mathematician by the name of Alfred Korzybski emigrated to the States as a late teenager and learnt English as a second language. And he said that the English language has a flaw. Some of his students later on took that metaphor further and said, well, if you consider your language, your inherent language, as your OS or as your Android operating system, that this operating system has a virus. And I was really interested by that. And he said that, Korzybski said that the is of identity and the is of predication is the problem, and that the concept of being cannot be described. It can't be done. What happens is you end up with a description of processes, of things doing things. So he said, you know, we're actually human doings because we're doing human things. We're not being human as some sort of inherent property that we have. So I pitched that when I was reading up, the kind of knowledge stopped around the late 90s. The last people started publishing papers on English prime. And one of the last things was written is that no one has ever attempted to write a creative work using this constraint, like a full-length creative work. There's books about it in it, and there's a couple of books on physics written in English prime, which is a natural process for physicists who can't say something is anything else. A particle is a wave, or they don't settle on that inherent being.
You've written an academic piece about this English prime. And you kind of say that really the use of is in English as it's written and spoken kind of forces us to be black and white, and it creates a false absolute in language, which you didn't want in the book.
That's right. We take shortcuts. For example, if my character said, oh, she is beautiful, the author of that sentence, she is beautiful, is assuming that their reader shares their aesthetic principles, which might not be the case. So if I was to say instead, her beauty reminds me of that statue of Venus in the British Museum, I've given it a description.
A description rather than an instruction.
Exactly. And also if the reader doesn't agree that that statue of Venus carved out of a block of marble in the British Museum is not beautiful, at least now they have an understanding of the author's aesthetics. Mm. So it's more effective storytelling. Mm. So
this has been done before. I think Georges Perec, the French writer, wrote a book entirely without the letter E in it. And it does seem like a kind of an Everest to achieve. A novel is hard enough. What was it like doing that? I mean, for me, I wouldn't know that this was the case. I would never have picked it up. But I do think there's a jauntiness about the language and a kind of a jarring immediacy about it.
That was another pivot on my PhD and proving that I'm contributing to knowledge. The Oulipo, which are a French writing group who work with constraints like Georges Perec, they say in their kind of guide to the Oulipo that there is no Oulipo book that has been written, a book with a constraint that doesn't contain some form of explicit instruction for the reader, whereas my E-prime book doesn't require me to say, hey, this is written in a certain way at all. So that was something groundbreaking also that got me through my PhD.
Well, Brently, there is this fascinating kind of semantic grammatical element to your book, but it's also about the rock and roll from the time. It's full of cultural references to, like, your picture magazine pops up at one point. I think you have captured a space and a time in Australian cultural history. Jenny Valentish, who is a writer for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, has made a fantastic observation about this book of yours, and she wrote that the night Brently Fraser loses his virginity, he's listening to Mondo Rock's Come Said the Boy. Later, he walks out of a psychiatrist appointment to the of Duran Duran's Wild Boys. He samples betel nut in Papua New Guinea, sold by a woman who's breastfeeding a piglet while wearing The Cure's Boys Don't Cry t-shirt. She actually missed one, which is, I think there's at least one reference to The Lost Boys, the 1987 film.
The actual film, yeah.
Is this a homage to The Lost Boys?
Yes. A lot of the other characters, particularly the male characters in my book, didn't end up as well as I did. I don't want to ruin the story, but one of the main characters is in Tasmania in prison for life, for murder. And these broken boys that I came across were all just wounded souls. And while I was very cautious about telling their stories, I think I found a nice balance in showing my perspective of what I knew about their stories, and in that way helping them, those who aren't in the position to share their stories, do so. But there's a lot of kind of lost souls in this country, and I journeyed with some of them.
Brently Fraser, thank you for talking with us, and thank you for this book.
Thank you very much, Cassie. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Brently Fraser there. So his book's called Scoundrel Days, a memoir based on his teenage diaries, and that one's published by University of Queensland Press. And yes, he was speaking there to Cassie McCullough.